Welcome to class. This is part two and day three of preparing for the return of the habit. How you doing? More importantly, how did you do this week? Did you get a chance to do the homework? Yes, thank you. We're going to talk about that soon. Let's see. How many people didn't do the homework? Please raise your hands. Did not. Really? I saw four hands. That's all? Well, that's pretty good. Five-ish did the homework-ish. All right. Was that to raise your hand to vote? Or are you saying something? I can lower your hand. You raised it to vote. Okay, thanks. And two? All right, thanks. All right, there we go. So that means most of you did the homework. That's cool. I'm glad to hear it. I hope those of you who didn't do it had plenty of guilt-ridden moments to entertain yourselves with for not doing the homework. Preparing for this class, I realized that I had, well, my original plan was, it was grandiose, I think. I mean, it was just like, there was so much stuff I wanted to cover. And in thinking about what we were going to do, I pared it down quite a bit because I was thinking of one of the general ideas. And in terms of learning, is that learning goes from the particular to the general. Right? I think, you know, we can generalize when we have enough experiences. So I realize in my own, in starting to prepare for the class, and in my own enthusiasm and desire to share my discoveries, that I you know, like I thought of many different strategies that we have for, I think in Feldenkrais terms, we'd say, integration, right? For taking what you learned in a lesson and incorporating it into your self-image and making it a part of your life and how you move, right? Taking it forward. That's one definition of integration. I don't think it's the only one, of course. But when I thought about what I wanted you to have at the end of the time that we worked together, I thought it was much more important to have something you could do than to have a bunch of ideas that we could talk about. I mean, the ideas will come and we can talk about them. So week before last, yes, I focused on one idea, one particular, I don't know what to call it. It isn't really a technique, because within what we did, there are many techniques. I guess it could be a tactic. It's kind of more like a strategy, because it straddles the whole lesson, right? It's not something that happens in one moment. It doesn't work if you start it at the end. You have to start it from the beginning. something that works over time and in more than the time of one lesson. And in a way, it's a revision or an update of something we all know, right? Think of all those weight loss ads with before and after, right? So this idea of comparing is something that we're familiar with, and yet it's presented in a different way. So I would love to hear what everybody has to say. I'm probably the only person here who would love to hear what everybody has to say, you know, because those discussions, well, I don't know. I think after listening to a few people, you kind of run out of interest, right? In the evaluations of every course I've ever done, those group discussions always come out on the bottom. I mean, I love them, but I don't think most students love them. I don't know what how I feel about them as a student, but I'm talking about it here as the convener and leader of this meeting. So I'm going to propose that we do something. Sherry, I know you're doing the groups. I'd like to do groups of three. I'm giving you a warning so you can set them up while I'm talking. Is that okay? And oh yeah, that reminds me of a piece of business. I'm glad you're back, Sherry. Jane, thanks for keeping the ball rolling and sending out all those notices to people and the recordings. My friend June isn't going to be here today. She had a I don't know, an important family thing to attend to, and I'm really happy that she got to do that this weekend. She might pop in and out if she can make some time. And I told her she was welcome to do that because she's been my I don't know, she's been my partner in putting this course together beforehand, and we met several times between last week and this week, and she's a good sounding board. And anyways, hopefully we'll see her again. So in this next bit, we're going to do something very incredibly, unthinkably un-Feldenkraisian. We're going to do a few lightning rounds, right? Think of it as a Feldenkrais pedagogical version of speed dating, right? So this is how it will work. You're going to be in a group with two other people. I'm going to ask you a question and give you a brief amount of time to talk about it. And by brief, I mean not enough. Certainly not enough by Feldenkrais standards, where we would like to wring the last little bit of juice out of the discussion. That's not going to happen. So I'll ask you a question. You'll be in your groups, you'll discuss that question. We'll come back. We'll talk briefly about what that was. You'll pop back in your groups. I might just send you a question in the middle of the groups. If I do, I will send it twice because those messages go by really fast. And I'm telling you, I'll send it twice so that if you don't read it all the first time, it'll be back again. All right? I'm giving myself a little leeway. In terms of that, yeah, Sherry, there's a few people in the chat who don't want to be in groups. So if you want to adjust that accordingly, and right now everyone's in room one, everyone but one person, so that didn't work.
So Larry, neither Sherry nor I have ever set up breakout rooms.
Okay.
So,
Okay. I'll do it. Here, y'all,
mean,
give
we're
me a
happy to
s
try, but,
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know what just happened there, but that didn't work. Let me We just have to wait till everybody comes back. Well, not everything works. That's okay.
That was fast.
That was a mistake.
That was lightning, man.
It was, it was. It wasn't supposed to happen that way, but you know, life is like that. Well, I don't know why Alina is still in her room. Everyone should be back. All right.
How do you get back?
Pardon me?
How do you get back out of the room?
I think you just, there at the bottom, there's a thing that says return.
No.
Or leave, and you can either leave
Well,
the
there's
meeting
something
or
that
leave
said
the room.
not now, and I thought that that meant do not push the join now button.
I'm sorry, Rosa. I'm trying to set this up and answer your question at the same time.
Well, then don't, but I
yeah,
just
let me,
don't know how to get out.
Maybe someone can
Larry,
answer
Larry, I'm
Rosa's
going to
question.
answer Myrna's question while you
Yeah,
do the
please.
breakout rooms. Hi,
Yeah.
Myrna. How's it going?
Good.
I'm Moira.
Oh, yeah, that's Moira. I recognize her voice. Hi, Moira.
Hi, how's it going? Listen, so I think, Myrna, what you're referring to, what you saw, was a little square that showed up on the screen we're on now that said join now or don't, maybe.
Not now.
Not now. So that's a different thing from what. So you didn't go into the breakout room, right? Because you pushed not now, I think. Am I right?
You're right.
Okay, so that's good. So you didn't see the thing that Larry's was describing because you weren't in that breakout room. If you go into a breakout room and you discover you shouldn't be there, you don't want to be there, somewhere toward the bottom, if you bring your cursor down, you're going to find an option to go back to the main room.
Yeah, I think it actually says leave. And you can either leave the meeting or leave the room. And if you leave the meeting, you can always log back on. So don't worry about that mistake. No one will die or be injured. Okay? All right. I think I've got this set up. So look, there is, for those of you who don't want to be in rooms, just don't join them. Well, actually, I think what I'll do maybe is I will put everyone who doesn't want to be in a room with other people who don't want to be in a room. And that way you don't have to be there, but otherwise it doesn't matter. You can stay in the main room for this portion.
Larry, what are we discussing?
First I have to get this set up and then I can tell you. Don't worry, I'm not going to send you there before telling you. Well, I'm not sure. You know what? I've done that before. So, you know, like every mistake that can be made, I have made already. So maybe I won't repeat them. Okay, so there'll be a few steps here. The first time you go in the room, you can introduce yourselves. Tell each other where you're from. I don't know if it matters what training you were from, because you're here, you know? And no matter how long you've been practicing the work, well, you're still involved in learning. So I think that makes us in that way equal. I'd like you to discuss first, what was the most surprising thing about our last time together for you? Yeah. Let's stay out of the I can't believe so and so wore such and such to a Zoom meeting, you know, because who cares? But you know, in terms of the content, what was something you didn't expect, or maybe in retrospect, after we spent our time together in the intervening 2 weeks, what what came up, what stuck in your craw, that was surprising. All right, so let's see. I'm going to create these rooms. If you don't want to join in a room, just don't press the button. You can stay in the main room. If it turns out that there's a room with four people or two people in it, I'll do my best to rearrange it. I won't leave a room with anyone in it. And finally, three people, 2 minutes each. Okay, so I'll call you back. I'll give you an extra minute for free in 7 minutes. We're going to do like three cycles of these. Nathie Fischbacher.
Yes, Larry, I was here last time. Should I join a room? I'm interested to hear what they have to say, but I don't want people to miss out on anything.
I'm sure you listened to all the videos.
Part of the first one.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, I think you should join a room and... listening is good.
Okay.
You can still introduce yourself. I think that would be worthwhile. All right. So here, every room has three people in it. Hopefully no room has two people who don't want to show up, but we'll see that soon. I'll rearrange people as need be. And Sherry can always pop in if we need an extra person in a group. Is that okay? Yeah. All right. So I'm going to open the rooms. You accept if you'd like to. And please, if you were here, just accept. Go along for the ride. 2 minutes each. And let's remember Dr. Feldenkrais's wise words about, you know, going quickly without hurry. So, something surprising about last time. And I think I could pause the recording here.
Okay.
Yeah.
I hear
you. All right. Welcome back. So now we're going to play a little game. I would like to hear something. I'd like to be in the groups. I was telling Jane while you were all with each other that I wish I could listen in surreptitiously, because I would if I could, you know, like spy on you, because I'm just really curious. And I know if I go in the room, that changes the conversation, you know, and I don't know. I don't really care what people say about me because they say all kinds of stuff. But here, I care what you say about your learning. All right, so here's the thing. I want to hear what happened in the group. It's going to work like this. One person per group can talk. And at the most, not every group has to talk. And you can only say what someone else said. So you can report on what one of your compatriots said, but you can't say anything about what you say. So, what was surprising to you about what surprised someone else, I guess, is the question. Oh, please be shy for the next 10 seconds.
Here, I can start just to get the ball rolling. My partner was Sherry Lee.
Uh-huh.
And what was surprising for her was in the one-on-one that you did a week ago, 2 weeks ago today, how much the person changed through that process. And she was, that was surprising and exciting for her. And then we just chatted. I mean, we talked about the interaction and social interaction in Zoom classes that is pretty neat. But that's my report of Sherry. Okay.
Thanks, Scott.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Sherry.
I'll go and say
Nancy and Moira were my partners, and Nancy was surprised how much she wants to intervene and make changes for somebody else. And we all raised our hands and shook our heads, yes. And she also was commenting on how interesting the self-discovery of her student opened as she was listening and asking questions from the content of the weekend. Moira had an interesting point about, she said that the homework included doing reverse pecking. And Nancy and I did not follow, we didn't catch that, that you would ask the person to do reverse pecking instead. And I thought, well, reverse pecking is forward pecking. But anyway, that was an interesting point. Thank you.
You know, the homework was as complex as you needed it to be. Right? So there are layers there. Someone else.
This is Betty. I'll report on our group, Myra and Lenore. And I think both people were surprised at the return of habits in teaching and in having repercussions from doing the lesson this weekend that was surprisingly uncomfortable for one person, and the desire to improve the movement of the student was noticed as a habit that came back so quickly, and not so much one that was what our work was about.
Yeah, but it is strong, isn't it? That feeling that we should be doing something. Right? It's like, it is, I don't know if this fits your experience, but it isn't an intellectual desire, right? It's not a thought that we have. It's like sitting in a room where the painting across the room is askew. Right, it's, you can tell it's just a little off, and it's not that you notice it and, you know, move on, but it gnaws at you, right? You like want to get up, or you're sitting behind someone in a theater and their collar is crooked. Like, no one else can see that. It's not going to interfere with their enjoyment of the movie, but it is interfering with your enjoyment of the movie. I don't know if either of those speak to you. I know. I go to meetings. No, anyways. But it is a compulsion. It is a behavior. And it is driven. I know that we're not in therapy. But it's driven by a feeling. Right? By a felt need. It's not some vague intellectual puffiness that floats away. It has a motor, right? It impels you. Sometimes you're doing the movement of doing it and realizing, oh, I'm trying to improve things. And all of that is great. All of that is learning. Right? Because now you recognize that you're doing it. Before, you didn't even think about it. You were just busy doing it. Right? So if you notice that about yourself, that means you are now engaging in this. You know, some people have a swearing jar at home. I have a journey jar, so I'm going to say this word, but I got to put money in the jar. You're engaging in the learning journey. Everything is a journey now, right? You have a cancer journey, you have a whatever, diet journey. Okay, but anyways, learning journey. I mean, you have taken a step forward, right? Because now you're aware of what you were doing. You've been doing it all along. You might be frustrated by how compelled you are. You might be annoyed that I was right again, and you should be. But that's progress, right? I mean, it wasn't. Yeah, so I think we could use your experience right now as a way of thinking about habits and how they return. And how awareness, right, beginning to notice what you're doing is the beginning of change. Because if you don't know what you're doing, you can't do what you want. You can also not do what you don't want. That was three. So it's still negative, in case you're counting. And, you know, I think we kind of got, and it is at least an exaggeration to play the Disney music in the background and have little butterflies and flowers opening and rainbows, and awareness is beautiful. Awareness is ugly. It is, because you see the ugly parts of you. I mean, sometimes you see what everybody else sees and it doesn't look that great. Or you see what you're doing and, I mean, why are you doing that? You know all this stuff about awareness, and yet you're still compelled to try to change someone's behavior. Right? You still think, I mean, it's like you almost don't believe in the lesson. The lesson is a journey. Oh, there I go again. Shit. I'm going to be broke by the end of the day. But anyways, you are sorry, I lost track there. I was just so pissed about this word journey at the moment. It interrupts.
Still compelled to change.
Well, yeah, to change. Yeah, thanks, Rachel. I actually found the thread. Even though you know better, right? I mean, if you trust the process of the lesson will lead to what you're trying to cheat with right now. Right, I'm not saying you shouldn't, you know, if somebody's doing something, they're going to hurt themselves. It's not that you shouldn't stop them. I'm not saying that you can't point things out in the beginning. Actually, I'm saying the opposite. That you can, not that you should or you should do it every time, but you can point things out at the beginning in a way that's noticeable, in a way that doesn't undermine the person's self-confidence or self-worth. This is not the only thing to do in terms of how to interrupt the habit, what did I say last week? I said, what if we imagine, whether you agree with it or not, what if we imagine that the habit will return? Like, as if it's a fact. And how would that change how we act? Okay, cool. Any other surprises?
I'll share. We didn't
Thanks, all. Heidi.
Yeah, sorry, that's Heidi. Uri shared that he tried it out in I think it was a class group setting, and had the students do the what they did at the start of the lesson, or trying to move in a way that they moved at the start of the lesson, and how hard it actually was to perform in that way or to come from that place, which I think ties into, well, what you just said as well, that even, yeah, anyway, I'll only share what he shared because I'm not going to put my own thoughts on it. But yeah, that was his experience.
Well, Murray, you're a daring man, right? If I wasn't clear last week, I apologize. Well, that example, which you just proved to yourself, that particular strategy doesn't work really well in ATM settings. It doesn't work because it is that there it's really hard for people to sense a link between either the before state, right, how they were when they came in, how they are when they come in, and then the after. And it's like, kind of, you know, if you feel a change, and for most people, they don't want to go back to before. That's why they came to the lesson. Why would they go back there? They just left. And also, when they feel the differences, they remember what it was like, but I don't think they find the door. This process works, at least in part, because of the investment you make in the beginning with creating the common ground, right? Starting on the same page. So it's not a matter of telling the person what they're doing or of them telling you what they're doing. It's a matter of, through this process, which, I mean, I don't know what you did with your students at the beginning, right? We took one movement, a slice of the lesson, a diet thin slice, right? Just one incredibly constrained action. The position was limited. The movement was described in such a way that if you follow that, like in an experiment, most of the parameters are controlled. They're not variable. And that only leaves a narrow range of observation, right? You have one range or one parameter or two, and it's easy for you and the student to notice this because you're not just noticing in a grand way. And you're not noticing on your own. You're noticing together. And so as you notice what they're doing, they notice what they're doing. You might have had an inkling before, but the point is to create a situation where people could find that together. Now, could you do that with a bunch of lay people? You know what I mean by lay people, right? The people in the class, because they come in and lay down. Sorry. That's actually really bad English grammar, because ducks lay down, but people lie down. If we're going to be really picky about English. But anyway, bad joke. You could do this with a bunch of normal people, right? By which I mean people who haven't spent time developing their ability to observe other people move and to talk about it. And that takes time, as you all know, for I think most everyone. You could do this with an ATM group. You would have to guide them through a modified and shortened version of the questions that you asked, and they would have to discover these things together so they could help each other go back to that in the beginning. But this is really more of an ATM strategy, an FI strategy. Today, we will do something more related to ATM. I think I said that last week, but I applaud your fortitude. But here's my question, Yuri. You told your group what didn't happen. I wonder what did happen. Did something interesting or beneficial? I mean, how did the students experience it? Was it a failure for them, or say something, say something. I don't speak hand gesture too much.
No, no, I didn't want to interrupt, but I was a guest with musicians introducing ideas, and I was very interested in what we learned 2 weeks ago. And the students seemed to be elated from the idea that even if they feel great just by remembering, just by noticing or being able to recreate something that was very difficult, they were actually happy that they did not remember or could not do it the way. And I seems like it has accomplished what my curiosity, and I'm still very curious. That's it.
Well, yeah, my point was, that experiment might not have worked, but you know, in a engaged class, students seem to make the best out of things, right? I mean, in my previous profession, I was a professional magician, and at my first like big show in a nightclub, which was a small nightclub in upstate New York, the last trick was that you take a big metal bowl, right, a bit like a big salad bowl, and you fill it with water, and you cover it with a big scarf, and you pick up the bowl and the scarf over it. You walk to the edge of the crowd, and you throw it up in the air, and the bowl and the water has disappeared. It's really quite stunning. I did it. I walked to the edge of the stage. I threw the scarf up. I grabbed the corner of it, and the bowl fell on the floor and rolled, da-wang, 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 and I was mortified. Now, before the show, I had invested in the future because I went around to every table in the nightclub, right? People were sitting at small tables, and I did a little bit of what we call table magic or close-up magic. You know, my thinking was, a group of strange acquaintances would be a lot friendly than a group of strangers. So, you know, I had gone by and met each group before. So at the end, I grab this, the bowl falls, it's rolling around and making quite a distinct sound. And someone in the front goes, "Oh my God, he made the water disappear." You know, students in this setting, even if your experiment didn't work, they have a funny way of still learning.
May I say something? I don't think the experiment did not work. My curiosity about it was the key. I didn't know what will happen. I was just curious, and just looking at the aura of yes, and just to see, and they walking out after that, something worked. I don't know, maybe yes, maybe no. I mean, for 1 minute, for 2 minutes, I don't know.
Well, so look, I think we're in violent agreement, sir, by which I think we're saying the same thing in a way. Like, the experiment that didn't work was for people to go back and forth, right? I mean, they weren't capable of doing that. I don't think that's a surprise. It doesn't mean they didn't learn, right? And doesn't mean that's not related with what's going on. So, yeah, cool. I like that. All right, let's do this one more time. So I'm going to send you back in a moment. Think back. over these last 2 weeks for a moment before you go back into your groups about when did what we did together 2 weekends ago, when did it reappear for you? At what moments, and excuse me, how did it change what you did? Right. So it might be that your response was to the memory, or to the person that you were, or people you were working with. But and is there some way in which help you tried something out, some experiment that you did? Right, because I asked you to take this on. Well, what if we pretend? What if we say, this is the way the world is? The habit's going to return, right? And how will that change what we do? I mean, I want to know how that reverberated. And what you learned, whether it's what you expected or not, or how it changed your interaction with a student or students. Is that clear enough? No questions? Oh, I love it when there are no questions. See you in, I'm going to say 9 minutes. 3 each. How's that? If you run out of things to say, of course you'd come back. As if that's going to happen. I doubt that will happen. Oops, you have to change outside of the meeting.
Maybe you can warn the group a little bit before you.
I normally, Yuri, when you close the room, it gives you a 1 minute warning, and that's not working at the moment. So something changed somewhere. So that's why I apologize. I mean, next time I can warn you, but you know, life is like that. You go to sleep and the next morning people are dropping bombs where you live. So the fuck. Sorry. Oh, let's leave reality out of this for the moment. All right. So same rule applies. I'd like to hear from the groups. What did somebody else say that you would like the other people here to know about? Scott again. Thank you, Scott.
I'm excited. Well, we kind of, and I mean, I'm going to break your rule. Maybe, I'm not sure. It depends how you umpire it. But it was Sherry, we kind of ended up on the same page. First, it took us a while to figure out what you were asking. And then we were both talking. She spoke about we wanted to ask you, because asking the client or student to bring back their pattern, we both remembered it. And she remembered it, but we weren't as explicit as perhaps you requested. So she spoke about like, oh, well, you know, putting a constraint and oh, is that a familiar constraint? Like, don't move your pelvis. And oh, and, you know, how does that feel in there in your neck? And then we both talk about and how they would go, oh, my gosh, that's what we would do. Or it was more playful, joking around. And I wondered, I think we were both curious and wanted to bring up. Well, I resisted being as explicit. We both resisted being as explicit as you asked and like consciously going back to their old habit at the end. And I know you've talked about noticing when it reappears. And we were sort of thinking, well, when our habits reappear in this, like, not doing what you asked. And I can be more explicit. We both say, well, Sherry said, well, this gives a different angle or a different way of approaching kind of the things we were discussing about awareness of what people do to get in their own way or noticing what they're already doing. I think that's enough to give you an idea.
Yeah, I think you gave us those enough examples of not being able to follow directions.
Oh, no.
Yeah, okay. You know, Scott and I have known each other for a long time, so he gets a special hard time. Well, look, I don't mind you breaking, you know, if you didn't know it was a rule, you wouldn't be breaking it, right? So,
I must say it was I realized we had broken the rules in our discussion, both of us. So
that's a, no, whatever. But look, I think what's interesting, well, there's a lot that's interesting about that. What is relevant to what we're talking about is, what stood out for me is that you hesitated in being so explicit about bringing back the before, right? And you both did. You both hesitated. I wonder if other people had that experience. Right, of so look, the thing is, it was incredibly explicit what we did, and the description isn't so much the important part of what was explicit, because the before was a specific movement in a specific situation, right? See, that's what has to be explicit, that you bring them back to doing the movement that you did at the beginning, whatever it was.
Oh, we did that.
That's what we, yeah.
Yeah, so if you do that, it doesn't take much cueing for the person to go back, because look, habits return. Often they'll go back whether they want to or not. Like they'll do it the new way. And you say, well, what was it like before? And that's all it takes for them to, let's say, all of these are metaphorical descriptions, but let's say to fall back into their experience of themselves, of how it was before. The minute they have the slightest, I'm mixing sensory metaphors, the slightest whiff of that organization and how it felt, then it will return. Right? And it isn't really that hard for most people, unless they're really scared, you know, to go back. It isn't that hard for most people to go back. And if people are scared, I think you have to say to them, I said, look, we got to this new place. In the work that we did together, I can help you get back here if you lose your way. And you might not know that, but you can. And it, in a way, it doesn't matter what you think, but my way of thinking about it is that again, I'm using our terminology as to point to something. If it's not clear what I'm pointing to, you could say something, but I'm using the person's organization, right? We want to, it doesn't take, like the example that you gave, it doesn't take much cueing to help someone bring go back to the where they were. With most people, it does take this kind of to be general, right? And you could say, since you had the process of discovery, like, I mean, I figured I would do the homework this week. And I did it explicitly, step by step, you know, kind of following the recipe with someone I've been working with for a while, with whom I've done things like this with before. But anyways, she had a hard time remembering how she lowered her head and lifted it and blah, blah, blah. And so I said, well, do you remember that when we did this together, there was this place here that you that didn't move, that every time you started got tight. And she said, oh yeah. And the minute she did that, she was back there. If someone is afraid of not being able to get back there at the end, right? Like you've like Sisyphus, right? They've gotten almost to the top of the hill and then boom, they're back at the bottom again. I think you have to say, it's easy to get back there. And if you can't find a way, I mean, it's easy now at the end of a lesson to get back to where you were at the end, because I believe that organization, again, metaphorically speaking, is kind of like hovering in the air. It's on the back burner. It is still close at hand in the nervous system. And it's really easy to go back to the FI and to do some part of the FI close to the end of it, not the end of it, some distinction, some differentiation that will bring them back to the end of the lesson, right? I think, and we'll talk about this by some strange coincidence later, that I would also like you to imagine that the world that we live in is one in which you don't have to redo the whole FI to reconnect with the benefit, meaning you to change your organization. You don't have to go through that whole process once you've done it once, right? And that's what would happen. You take the person back to the FI, even if it said it takes a couple of steps from the lesson, it is almost always, well, I'm saying that because I'm hedging my bets, but I have never had this fail. And if it did fail, I go back and just do a little more of the lesson, right? But you bring the person to the new organization and then you repeat the process again. You might have to redo a bit at the end of the lesson twice or three times, so that they can separate out those states and be able to switch back and forth. It is a totally human capacity. If it's not working, then you can address what you see happening that might be interfering with it. But the thing is, every time I did it this week, what surprised me was that when you get to that step and you're shifting from the new way to the old way to the new way to the old way, when they come back the second time, usually, right, the second time, to the new way, that it's not just that they learned how to do this once. They learn that they can do this, right? That it's possible for them, that it's not like once you've lost it, they have to come back and get more lessons, right? This is the opposite of building dependency in the student, is giving them the sense that they have some way of interacting with their nervous system. So it's, the habit's going to come back. That's fine. But now what do you do? This is one thing you can do. It isn't changing everything, right? It's this specific action in this particular place. But if you can do it in more than one way, that's what choice is about. Distinctions make action possible. Right. Once you can tell the difference, you can act on it. And this strategy, it's just one way. Right. But I figure if you have one way and you know that that can work, you might at one point get interested in other ways. Okay. Someone else from your groups.
I'd like to just piggyback on that, because one of my colleagues, Moira, was speaking about the difficulty of getting back to the new way, and that there's an emotional content that was inhibiting that return. And so she brought that up and we were grappling with that. Like, but now you're addressing it in this way about a state and changing state in order to get back there. But I do find with my clients as well that the emotionality of these things needs another comment. Maybe you could share. Thank you.
Does that make sense to other people as well? Yeah. Okay. I see some people nodding. I'm just curious. Let's take a giant step backwards. Mother says we may. Oh my God, that is, if you're not from the North America, you might not. That's a reference to a children's game. Let's take a step backwards though. Learning. Oh, I'm going to say it one more time. Okay, I might as well get this out of my system. Learning is an emotional journey. Right? I mean, it is not academic. In other words, it's not just about the content. You're interested. You're excited. You're bored. You're frustrated. You're annoyed. You feel stupid. All of those things are emotions. Unless we address the emotional aspect, meaning, you know, the flavor of the person's experience, where they, I mean, their emotions, that tells you who the person is that you're dealing with, right? Because they're experiencing the moment as, I don't know, maybe they're overwhelmed, or maybe they're really curious. As teachers, we want to encourage certain emotions like curiosity. And we want to recognize the things that get in the way of learning, or most obviously get in the way of learning, like being afraid, thinking that you don't know anything or that you can't learn, thinking that you already know. I mean, well, I should say feeling, right? Feeling overconfident, feeling overwhelmed, and address that, right? Every student brings their entire experience as a learner to this moment. You know, their history is there. We would like to help people learn to act independently of their history, to act in the moment, not out of the past. But, I mean, we all do that. So I think the first thing is about emotions. I mean, you know, if you learn about emotional intelligence, I think the beginning of emotional intelligence is, what a surprise, awareness, meaning recognizing what you feel. As teachers, not as therapists, but as teachers, I think we can help the person. You can recognize, you can acknowledge that they're feeling something, right? I mean, I don't mean in a heartless way. You could say, well, you look hesitant, or you're looking at me as if you're not sure what I said. Am I reading that correctly? Right? I don't want to interpret someone's feelings. I want to ask them about it in a way that gives them a chance to clarify what I'm saying. Because even if I'm wrong, oh no, I'm not afraid. I'm annoyed. Oh, how's that? Sometimes that's enough, right? Because awareness changes things. But I think ignoring how somebody feels means you are not dealing with the person. Right? As a human being, because, I mean, our feelings are where we're at. One way that the structure of the lesson, acknowledges and makes room for that, and in a way anticipates it, is by saying to the student, you're going to hate what I say next. Or most people do, right? And then they do. Like, I don't want to go back there, right? When you first propose that. But if you know, their second thought is, oh, that's what you said I was going to do, right? And I mean, I think that it takes away the sting of the moment. Right? And often when we're recognize something, right? When somebody points something out to you in a social situation, the first feeling is shame. Right? For a lot of people. And that can happen in our situation, even if you're not being judgmental. Somebody feels bad for having done it wrong, or for not having known it, or just for having been seen in a way that they didn't even know was visible to other people. And I think that's how we're wired. And that's okay. I mean, it's part of being social beings, but it doesn't mean we have to stop there. If it is someone's history, you know, this experience, whatever it is, and it has that familiarity, we also can't expect that to change instantly. Right? We can't demand that they be different or their attitude change, but we can acknowledge it. And we could say, look, you can say to someone, well, I know this seems odd, and I understand your reluctance to go back. Or most people don't want to do this because they're afraid if they go back, they won't find their way to this new way of doing. And look, if it doesn't work this time, then we can work on how to make that better next time. Right? It's not failure, it's feedback. It lets you know where the other person is along the way and being able to do it. So you have to adjust what you're doing to where they are. Sometimes you have to go half a step backwards or give them more time to figure it out. But the purpose is learning. This is a strategy. This is a way in which someone can marshal the resources that they were given, the way their nervous system works, in a way for their benefit, right? Not to be haunted by it, but to be able to grab the steering wheel and do something that can change their experience. If we live in a world where we expect the habit will return, right, then our job is to prepare the student for the return of the habit such that the return is part of the process of learning. If we can count on it coming back, that's great, because, you know, people will forget about shit. You know, you give someone an exercise or an assignment, and I don't know how many times you've done this, but people forget them. The well-intentioned, the intelligent, the charming, and the beautiful. I mean, everyone forgets. So if we know that, then we can give them something written down. We could send them a text message. I'm serious, right? What if there's ways of interacting? But look, what's better than carrier pigeons? I mean, no, what's better? The habit's going to come back. That could be the trigger for continuing to learn. It seems like wasting that is missing an incredible opportunity. Okay, maybe one more group. no one said anything interesting, or you're still thinking about what I just said. Maybe something else. I don't know. All right. Well, I'm going to change. Just we'll take a break in a minute. So before we go forward, anyway, we went backward, right? This is review. I talked about that last week. And, you know, I think the upshot is review is important. Let me say that again. I wonder if there are any questions that you want me to answer today or tomorrow. You know, telling me at the end of the day tomorrow that I didn't answer a question that you didn't ask isn't fair. And if you're wishing that I would ask it, this is your moment. Not saying I'll answer it now. I probably won't, but.
Larry, I'm still answering the question before, but someone in my group mentioned that a pattern she observed in herself was an urge to fix. And that was something that was kind of like the overriding theme about the whole thing was, there's a desire to fix here that I have to interrupt in myself to follow this process.
Yeah. Congratulations, huh? I mean, it's always good to have a project to work on. And I think it's a common one because we're all here to help people. The road to hell, etc. Okay, questions? Any questions? I did receive a couple through various means of communication, and I've already answered one, and the rest are coming, so.
Okay, I do have another question, Larry.
Moira?
So I remember you, and it could, maybe I got this wrong, but I feel like part of our homework was to do reverse pecking with the same kind of guidance. Did I get that wrong?
You know, I'm not going to answer your question, but this is such an old-fashioned reference. But, you know, newspaper journalism, writing for a newspaper, is a really particular kind of linguistic structure, because you never knew in the old days, right, you had a limited amount of space. And you had to fit the ads and the photos and the text in there. And so articles were written where the most important information comes first, right? And the rules of English grammar are broken, that because it's both in the sentence structure and in the paragraph structure and in the overall structure, meaning that the least important stuff was last on every level. So you could cut the last paragraph, or you could cut half of a paragraph, or you could cut, like, because you coming from the tail end, you can make it as short as possible. So the homework was kind of built like that. If you start at the beginning and you could add more and more detail. So if you could do all the part at the beginning, it would be good to have something to do that you hadn't done. Right, but it doesn't mean you would get to it. And okay, I think we're going to take a break. Unless somebody has something you want to say, we'll take a short break. We're going to come back and.
Hi, Susie. Now there is a Susan Kraut.
Hold on a second. I'm going to take care of that. I have the power to do that. It's so cool. We will jump from what we did, but we're going to change focus a little and talk about how these ideas might work in ATM. Right. These ideas, not the before and after strategy, but what can we do to help someone? What do we give someone to do in an ATM that acknowledges that the habit's going to return? Right, that gives them something to do, not necessarily because it returns, but again, if we assume it's coming back and we don't have the kind of personal interactive possibilities with the whole group. So what's one strategy you could use in ATM? And I'm going to give you something that is it's kind of a two-in-one deal, two for the price of one. So this is something you can teach your students, and this is also something that you can use in your own practice. And I'll ask you this evening to practice it, to do this. This will be your homework between today and tomorrow, so that tomorrow when we come back, we can talk about it, right? So we will do some leading up to and some practicing things that will make this easier. We'll do an ATM. And then we'll talk about the strategy more. That's kind of the plan for today. And tomorrow, we'll talk about what your experience was like test driving this. What problems you ran into, what interfered with you being able to do it in your own, exercising this, trying it out for yourself. So that when you do it with your students and they have responses, you'll be ready for the response. So in other words, I don't want to just teach you something you can do and have you practice it, but I want to talk about what happens the next time, right? Because we would all hope that students are going to come back and go, oh, it was a miracle. But, it won't be because, learning is a process and it is challenging. Habits are insistent. That's their nature. They are compelling. That's the way we are. Whether I can explain it in a way that says why is happening, I don't know. I don't know if it matters at the moment. We're not there yet, I don't think. And if you explain it, I think you're going to tell me more about how you think these things work. And maybe they work or not, but the structure of how this happens, how we experience it, right? Because it happens to us. I mean, it is a part of us. The autopilot that's making this happen. But in a way, we're not doing it, right? It's the autopilot is automatically, by default, in charge of all these physiological processes, right? So the ones that you can't, it doesn't matter if you're distracted, like you're breathing, circulation, digestion, all those things are going on. They're happening inside the envelope of your skin. Your nervous system is sitting in the driver's wheel, and yet it doesn't quite feel like you. I mean, it is you, but you're not in control of it. That's what happens with the habit, is that same automaticity, and changing it shouldn't be that easy. right? Because there would be problems if you were that malleable. There's some continuity. I mean, that experience, when I'm saying you, that continuity, how else would that be constructed, right? That to maintain a sense of self across time and through physical changes, that's an interesting thing. So I think that the tenacity of the habit might have something to do with that as well. We don't want that to change easily, right? You would like to wake up tomorrow and remember today from your perspective. And that's that whole sense. So I think if we acknowledge that too, then we can say, it's silly to think that you're going to get a lesson or do a lesson by yourself. No matter how good that lesson is at that moment, that you will be different forever. The only time that happens is under duress, right? We call that shock or trauma. So I don't think we want that to happen in everyday learning. It makes sense that it takes some time. So quit your whining about it. It's not a bad thing. We should be on the side of that. I asked you last week to what if we live in this world, and I'm living in it for the moment, right? And I'm speaking to you as if this is true and imagining what that would be like. And I'm like one of those actors who gets off the stage and can't stop being the character that they're portraying, right? So I'm trying to be really consistent. So you have this idea, well, what would it be like if we really believe that the habit's going to return and that is of evolutionary importance? It is significant. It is necessary. It's not bad because certain things return that you no longer like. You know, your nervous system doesn't really care. The universe doesn't care how you feel about it. That's not going to change it. All right, so we'll take a break. I just want to give you an overview, and I'm going to keep needling you, right? Well, I'm going to keep poking a little bit. I hope I'm doing it gently. I'm striving for a kind of consistency in this belief. And in doing so, I want to point out all the times that you kind of fall back on the fairy tale, right? I mean, it's not that people don't change in incredible ways that last their lifetime sometimes. But often, you know, it's like the pickle jar. Somebody else loosened it, and now you can open it. Those changes take time. And they might happen in an instant. But it took a while, most of the time, to get there. I think most lessons are not the instant kind. All right, it is 20 minutes before the hour. Would you come back at 5 minutes before the hour? So a 15-minute break? Whatever the time is where you are, okay? Thank you.
Sure, Larry. I think it's Lenore. I misunderstood something.
Stop that. I am, I want to do something just before the ATM, so to prepare you for what we're going to do after.
Great. Thanks.
And I'm going to talk to you in that context, not so much as a student, but as a teacher. You'll see what I mean. Okay?
Thank you.
Good question. Thanks. Oh, you already stopped it. All right. Well, so I'm silence my. If you haven't silenced your phone, you could do that now. Hi. Welcome back. The last time when we were together, last two weekends ago, I, a couple of different times, talked about how we think about our job. What? How do we describe our job? You know, what are the parameters? Even before we go to this idea of the habit and how learning works and forgetting, one of the things that's important, whether what in whatever context you're doing a lesson, hands-on, in person, or online, group or individual, one of the premises that's at the heart of what we do is that there's a difference between doing and learning. These are not the same, you know, I said states earlier, and I was thinking during the break, maybe modalities or ways of being. I don't want to be abstract about it, but when you are doing in everyday life, you are relying on the repertoire of abilities that you've developed and the things you've learned to notice and to understand. It is difficult, not impossible, to do something new in the middle of doing because you're relying on the repertoire that you have. Moshe talked and Amherst about, you know, somebody who's a great runner. I think he was running, and this, the environment changes. So they go from running on asphalt to running across country. And they can't adjust to it. Or they go from, like, we just had the Olympics, from practicing at sea level to running, you know, doing whatever their sport is, someplace at a much higher elevation where the air is thinner. You know, if they can't adapt, then, you know, the thing they're good at it becomes problematic. So we have, you know, it's hard to change that. It takes time and training and all of that. So to be able to change what you're doing is what happens in the process of learning. And in a way, what I think Moshe is suggesting, he talks about this in the beginning of the Awareness Through Movement book, is that you are either in learning mode or in doing mode. And part of our job with students is to help them develop the ability to switch, right? To recognize that learnings to do something new is different than doing something that you already know how to do. Everything we do with a student, everything that happens in a lesson, is dependent on the student being able to shift gears. And since we're talking about awareness, right? I mean, if you don't know you're in one gear, how do you know to shift it? You have to be able to make that distinction and appreciate it. I'm saying that because I think at first, the first time encountering the method, is people will leave with a generalization such as, you know, going slower is beneficial. And they'll kind of think that everything should be slow. Well, not in everyday life, but there's this, as if slowness is what matters. But slowness going slower than usual is part of what gets us out of doing, you know, which is paying attention to the end, what we want to accomplish. Picking up the phone, opening the door, lifting the grocery bag, right? We're paying attention to, well, Alexander called it end gaining. We're paying attention to the end of what we're doing, the purpose of it or achieving it. Instead of, again, Alexander's language, instead of paying attention to the means whereby we are doing it, right? To how we're moving. We're paying attention to what we're doing instead. And if we want to change what we're doing, we have to pay attention to how we're doing it. That's a shift. And one way to help someone notice what they are doing is to get them unpoetically and in the vernacular to slow the fuck down. I mean, I don't mean to be rude, but I'm, you know, being American, I'm using that word for emphasis. If you don't slow down, I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it's a lot more difficult. Excuse me. So I would like that thought to linger. I'd like to relate it to something that you probably know. And that is to how difficult it is to do, for most of us, to do ATM lessons on our own. It's difficult because it's difficult to remember the structure of the whole lesson, right? For most people, especially if they don't have any practice at it. I don't know what it was like for you, like when you started a training and, you know, if you were taking notes at the end of the day, you try to remember the lesson, or you met with other people and you realize that they weren't at the same lesson that you were, you know, you remember different things. But that's part of the complexity. And the other part, I think, and you can tell me if this rings true for you. The other part is it's hard to get back into, let's say, the rhythm of doing the lesson, right? So we tend to do lessons in a less mindful way, right? We tend to do them the movements more performatively without slowing down as much as you might have in a lesson. Whoops. As much as you might have in a lesson. Does that make sense for you? I mean, I know, like, when I started working as an assistant trainer, I had to do lessons I'd never taught before from the notes. And I kind of resented it. It was really difficult to do, to recreate the listening to myself that I was able to do when somebody else was guiding and pacing the lesson. Does that make sense? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah? So I think part of the challenge of this whole approach is how do we give someone the means for getting back in that group, for being able to shift into learning mode on their own. So I will, in what we're doing, I'm saying this up front, because I think we have to be ready for, if it's difficult for us who have done a ton of ATM, how do we expect that to happen for our students? Yeah, like how do we make it possible for them to get over that hurdle? So I'm acknowledging the hurdle. I'm I'm also, I think for, I think it's such a challenge that most people just say it's really hard to do on your own and they don't do it. Right? I mean, by most people, I mean most Feldenkrais teachers. I like to think of my job in every ATM class, part of my job, is not just to teach people that particular lesson in a way that they benefit from it, but to illustrate, to use that lesson as an illustration of what you can do for yourself, right? How you can help yourself, because ATM is inherently portable. You can take it with you. You don't need the teacher. But to do that, you have to believe that it works. And so my job in every lesson is to encourage the student to become a Feldenkrais practitioner. Now, I don't want to be the language police. I'm not implying that you have to speak the way I'm going to speak right now, but I just want to point out a difference. When I say a Feldenkrais practitioner, I do not mean someone who's been through a training, right? And who is using the method for the benefit of other people. I mean Feldenkrais practitioner the way that you might say yoga practitioner, someone who practices this approach for themselves. So I would make the distinction that, you know, in a class, that people in the class are practitioners, and I'm a teacher. And in a training, I'm a trainer, and they're future teachers. So I don't, you know, that in a training situations, I can answer a question that somebody asked me as if they're asking it, as if they're asking it as a student, or I can answer the question as if they're asking it as a teacher. Those are two really different approaches. And by student, I mean future practitioner, someone who's practicing the method on their own. And I emphasize this because if if learning is something that happens after the lesson, and if habits are going to return, then what we're teaching people has to be, I think it's our job. It's a responsibility to give them things to do after the lesson. Because, I mean, we all forget, right? And we can build on that, the moment of awareness that we forgot or lost track or of a way of being, of a mode, of a way of moving and noticing ourselves. We've got to give them ways of interacting with it on their own. That's what I mean by having a practice. And maybe on their own isn't even necessary. It's just without the teacher, we can give students things to do with each other in person and online. They could help each other, support each other in not just doing the lesson, but in practicing these skills. I think that's a consequence of taking seriously that the habit's going to return. And thinking about our responsibility is as how do you engage with the habit outside of class time in such a way that you begin to have choice about what happens without choice, right? I think part of that is, well, what else would you do besides the habit? It's not a matter of stopping the habit, but it's a matter of having something else to practice. I mean, if you're coming from the martial arts perspective, right, and you're in a situation where there could be danger, whether it's a competitive one or you know, being out in the jungle is danger, or just in a world that's dangerous, then stopping in order to do something is probably not the best thing to do. It's really hard in whether you're being chased by a lion or you're in a martial arts competition to say, wait, let me think about that for a second. Let me not do something, right? Because at that moment, you're not the predator, you're the meal. So doing something different is what's called for. That's to set the stage. I'd like to tell you for a few minutes a little bit about what what I've been learning about or what I've been exploring over the last few years. Both in FI and in ATM, which will take us into what you'll be doing. What I want to talk about is kind of I think it's an outgrowth of doing the work. I mean, either being in the teacher position or in the student position. One of the places this developed, and this is kind of a confession, I guess, is I've been participating on and off lately, more often on in the AYD meetings. And one of the things that's amazing about that context, I did a class this past week, and the person who taught is someone who'd been attending for a while, fairly new practitioner, teacher, but it was their first time teaching, right? And that's such a cool moment, because there's somebody who has been teaching classes, right, and doing ATM on their own, but here they're leading a group of colleagues through an ATM. And, you know, some people, it's really easy for them to do. And for some people, it's just really hard to just the first time of doing that. And you're presenting the lesson to people who are not just listening to the lesson, but might know where it's going, have different ideas about teaching. And, you know, some people do an incredible job. We just think, wow, this person's a natural. And some people don't do such a great job. Like, maybe their timing is really off. So I have found myself in lessons kind of, maybe you've had this feeling, you know, like, okay, can we move on to the next section? Like, I'm done. And the person, for whatever reason, they're still going. So in that situation, as a student, I go, well, I could like veer off in a different direction. I could think, well, I'm in this position, and what else could I do? Where else could I go? You know, sitting with my arms on the back of the chair like we did last week. And packing, and I could think of other places it could go, or I could think of, well, maybe I could do a pelvic clock here. Reasonable, probably useful, but I would leave the lesson. I would leave the trail that the lesson is taking me through. So I got really curious about what else I can do in that situation, right, in the position that we're in, exploring the movements that we're doing, and kind of keeping myself engaged, I'm not quite sure how. Maybe going deeper in the same direction? Do you know what I mean? So there are certain things that I started doing. I mean, one of them was just stopping. So, you know, in the structure of a lesson, we have the overall lesson. And one way to make a structure out of it is to think of the sections. So like chapters in a book, and then within the chapters you have sections, or acts in a play, right? So acts are the major sections, and within the act you have a scene. So here I'm saying you're staying in that scene and developing it further. And usually what happens is you do some action and you come back, right? Whatever that action is in the lesson. But what are ways of getting more mileage out of it? So one moment I got really interested in was right before you reverse, right before you come back. So metaphorically speaking, you know, you're going along, you do something, and then you return. So at the top of the movement. Like, what happens at that moment? So I would just stop there. And what I began to notice is there are places that if I stopped before I turned around, it would be difficult to stay there because I was working really hard, right? So whatever it is, let's take just a simple example of a lesson we've all done, the basic flexor lesson, right? Where you interlace your fingers, you put your hands behind your head, you lift your head, and at this phase of the lesson, you lift your head, and you lift your pelvis. So you're in that bendy C-shaped curve all along from, excuse me, as much as you can, from the top of your head to the bottom of your bottom of your pelvis. And I would just stop there. And after a few moments, I would notice that I'm not breathing. Or I'm working really hard to be here. I took both of those as signs that I had gone further than was reversible, right? Than was easy for me. I was doing too much. What a surprise. Right? But at that moment, I could back up to the place where I could still breathe, where I wasn't working hard. And sometimes I had to back the fuck up. I mean, like step after step. I would like barely begin to lift my head away from the floor. Just break contact with my pelvis. If I went beyond there, I went beyond the point of ease, right? I left. Moshe says in AY, he says, don't cross the border. Right? Meaning don't go to that place where you have to work harder to go further. And so what I learned from that is how, you know, again, how easy it is for me to push. Right? So within whatever we were doing, I could adjust how far I go. And that reignited my curiosity about what I was doing. Because before I was like, okay, I'm done with this. So my the constraint here is I'm not changing the position, and I am not changing the playground, right? If the movement, like in a folding lesson, almost always everything is folding. If you're not folding, you're doing something to make folding easier. It's in the service of folding. And it's within that sagittal plane. And if you leave the plane, like when you, bring one elbow more forward, so now you're introducing twisting, it's still twisting and folding, and it's there to make folding easier. Or you introduce, pushing your head backwards as you lift your pelvis. So you're going in the other way, but that is to facilitate folding, right? So I'm staying within the movements that are prescribed. And I'm asking, how do I get more out of this? Right? Because I don't want to change what's going on. But what I found about doing that, like changing the perspective of what I'm noticing and the moment along the trajectory of that highly prescribed and limited action, at that moment in that scene of that act of that lesson, having done the initial variations, again, without leaving that, I got so much more when I out of the action when I returned to it, right? Because I had looked at it through fresh eyes, right? Another thing I started to do was to take seriously this notion of what happens at the beginning. And so to go back to, well, there are two beginnings, right? Because there's the beginning of the journey home, and there's the beginning of the whatever that variation is. But to notice, so the question that most people ask themselves when they do anything, sorry, seems to be compulsively, how far can I go? And you can see that in how they move. And by they, I mean me and you. Sometimes it's how far can I move and how soon can I get there? So to, interrupting that pattern is one way to do that, is to ask them what happens at the beginning and to make the challenge be not how far or how soon, but how much. So how much of yourself can you notice at the beginning? We could say with your breath, right? Because I was just talking about breath. You breathe in, out, or not. But also, let's take the lifting your head part of that. When you lift your head, well, the weight of your head doesn't disappear. It has to go somewhere else. So when your head comes away from the floor, something has to push back. Can you notice that? Let's say it's the back of your shoulders. Well, what happens below that? Say between your shoulders and your pelvis. Does that go backward or forward? And can you notice your elbows and your head going forward, your shoulders going back, and whatever happens in the middle? And then can you add to that what happens with your pelvis? We go from the other end. You lift your pelvis. Where do you press? You could press at your feet, or you could press in the middle of your back somewhere, or somewhere along your spine, or at the back of your head. And then you could begin to play with those. Can you lift your pelvis by pushing your feet? Can you lift your pelvis without pushing your feet? Again, staying in the confines of the instruction. In any lesson, you cannot explore all of these things, right? Because the lesson would take forever. But in every step of the lesson, there is a way of, bigifying or deepifying the experience? I'm being silly in the words that I'm using because I'm not really sure how to describe it, right? But we're getting more out of what happens in that moment. So there we're paying attention to how we begin, like at the beginning, where does the weight change? That's one way of describing it, or what muscles contract? That would be another way. But muscles contracting, it's kind of harder to, maybe harder to notice. The floor or whatever surface you're on gives you feedback that you can attend to, that you have practiced noticing. But now you are making the sensory experience in that moment richer, which I think would be an equivalent of developing awareness. Right? Not by doing more, well, not by doing something different, but by within that moment exploring what's possible and what you can get out of it. Does that make sense? Does anybody have a question about what I'm saying? Does this relate to anything that you've done? Thank you. Okay, I'm going to continue, but I wonder if I make the question I just asked non-rhetorical and perhaps a little clearer. What are ways in which you might have explored this thing about this approach about inviting someone to have a richer experience of what they're doing, right? So this, again, is kind of the same thing of like last week's emphasis of not changing them, but helping them notice better. I want to say notice better because that's something you do rather than being more aware, because that's kind of passive. It's something that's happened. But here, you know, the way you notice is an action. And so I'm asking, are there ways you've done it before I go ahead? Yeah, Betty.
Well, it makes me think of talking about quality of movement.
Mm-hmm.
That may relate to what you just said about richer experience. That, and I think that language requires probably some further refinement for a class about the quality of movement. But it is a little bit different than talking about pace, fast, slow, just trying to give people a range, do a range of movement quality. And I think that...
I'm going to take you seriously, Betty. And I would say, so that we know that we're talking about the same thing, I think that requires a bit of refinement of the definition. Mm-hmm. So one way to talk about quality, I think there are two ways. One is the amount of oomph that you're using, right? How strong the movement is. And the other is how smooth it is.
Yep. When you talk about oomph, is that also effort? Is that, are mm-hmm. you? And also stealing from Alan Questrel, who frequently talks about, do you like it? Do you like the movement that you're doing? Do you enjoy? Do you take pleasure in it? Do you delight in it? And particularly at the end of a lesson to ask people to find out if there's something that has happened that they were especially delighted with, that they did, that to take away that.
Let's go back to this. I'm not disagreeing with anything that you said, But in terms of I think I'm trying to think of how you would say that in historical Feldenkrais jargon, of kind of deepening and spreading the attention, right? If we're talking about quality, I think one way of operationalizing that, because as a teacher, it has to be something that I can observe. So I can observe if somebody likes it, maybe by their facial expression, but it's something that I could observe but not do anything about. Same thing for them. But when it comes to smoothness, like you say, we can make it smoother or less smooth. Mm-hmm. Right? So that becomes something we can notice and something we can vary. And in that dimension, when we're talking about smoothness, we're talking about speed. Because when something isn't smooth, right, when you get that ratchety, that would be the opposite of smooth, the stopping and starting kind of movement, what's happening is that you are not moving, you're accelerating, you're moving a little faster, and then you decelerate suddenly, you stop, and you start, and you stop. So you're speeding up and slowing down in a step-like fashion, right? It's not a smooth curve. It is to like a step, right? And so that says it's about our relationship to time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm being really explicit about it, because if I want someone to notice it, and if I want someone to be able to play with it, right? If someone can't make it more smooth, they could make it more ratchety. Or they could do it on purpose, and they could move a teeny bit, stop, wait, move a teeny bit, stop, wait. You know, so that would be the other extreme. But it would serve the purpose of getting them to notice more what's happening in the moment. So in a way, what we're doing in that part of our of our duties as Feldenkrais teachers, it is kind of like, it's kind of like teaching meditation. It's like not meditation where you have a point of attention, but meditation where you have a wide and deep kind of attention, right? Noticing your whole body, but noticing in different ways. And I think if we want someone to be able to do that later, to have that as part of their repertoire of how they relate to themselves, something worth practicing doing. All right, but I am underlying this because in a way it's trivialized or underappreciated what a role it plays and what a role it can play in the dealing with the habit. Right, Scott, you're next.
Thanks, Larry. I wanted to go back a little bit, but I think it'll relate to your question. I was, when you talked about the two modes of learning mode or doing mode, mm-hmm. of myself, let's say, both in singing or playing tennis, there are times in tennis, say returning serve, where I'll consciously, I might do a little bell hand, I might, where's my weight, where are my hips? How am I shifting my weight? And then I go into doing. Obviously, in the middle of a point, I'm not, it's more automatic. And same with singing, rehearsing with a group or on my own. You know, I'll direct attention, or I know certain things that will recreate the whole of a more optimal organization for what I want to do. So, I mean, there you can apply that to the ATM, directed attention, going to more flow. Like in the pressing, releasing the worm, you know, that can be, and I know from, well, from Marcy, learning how to sing coloratura, you know, just going slow ain't going to get you to sing fast, although there are aspects of it. But it was a very similar thing. Just go, be sloppy. Or in The Worm, I mean, I love going, oh, well, like if you look at each one and then go back to the whole, you know, flow through. Sometimes it's really tricky to get your attention to do both of those things. But eventually you can just go back and forth and eventually you hold the whole thing, right? Like you're going, blah, 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 but you're going, oh, look at this little part or that little part. So I don't know, but I don't know if you meant it to make such a clear distinction between learning mode or doing mode.
I did.
Okay.
Well, because I think you...
How would you describe my examples of
singing? Well, I think your example shows that because it's like you have to do things separately. So you learn to make the distinction so then you can apply them, right? So, and your example is also, it implies that it took time to be able to do that. Right. And it's coming back to the specific context and practicing first, making the distinctions and then being able to apply them. So I think both of those examples acknowledge that it's not going to happen in a moment. And it's in the responding to the way that you are integrating or incorporating that gives you the next step. It's not a sign of failure. It's an indication of what aspect of what's going on needs to be further fiddled with in a constructive way. One of the things you said really stuck out, which is, I don't remember the exact words, but you were talking about how to bring back the whole, right? The whole feeling at the end of the lesson, which is what I'm talking about. Like without having to repeat the whole lesson, what ways do we have of revivifying? I think probably good to avoid resurrecting. Might have more to do with Feldenkrais, but you know, how do we conjure that? But bring it back to life? I mean, this is a really interesting question. And like I said before, I want to challenge this idea, this belief, I think, that most of us have, which is that you have to do the whole lesson in order to benefit from it. We have the experience that doing the whole lesson gives us a benefit. And we have the experience that it's difficult to do lessons on our own. So, of course, I mean, how would we know that we can bring back the benefit of the lesson without repeating it? Now, anybody else have an example of, like, what I was asking is in particular in your practice, like what you do as you do an ATM lesson and what you do on your own when you're on the floor and doing whatever it is that you do on your own on the floor. Are there ways that you have explored or found, discovered, invented even, of, I don't know, I like the getting more mileage out of, but in a way that's the wrong metaphor because it's like you're getting more out of the same mileage. Right? You're taking the same, oh, shit, there I go again, journey. But you're experiencing it in a richer way. All right. I want to describe one other strategy along the, maybe it's a tactic. It happens during a lesson. It's, yeah, I think it'd be the example. So let's take this same ATM situation. You have folded. You've lifted up the head of your arms. You've lifted that your head. You've lifted your shoulders. And you've lifted your pelvis. And so in this position, I'm not talking about how far you've gone. You could just barely take your head. Just break contact with the back of your hands and the back of your pelvis. So barely take both of those places off the floor. Or you could have gone, I don't know, to your extreme, whatever that is. And you can still breathe there. The thing that I found really fascinating was, I'm going to tell you what I call it, and then I'll give you the experience. I call it coming back, bringing half back, just starting to bring half back. So what I mean by that is you're at the top of the movement, head's lifted, pelvis is lifted, and then you just begin to reverse. You take your head back toward the floor. But only your head. Well, your arms and your head go back towards the floor. So it's the, you will notice a consistency about these things. It's the initiation, right? Just starting to come back. Think of it, the example as an everyday thing is like you're walking out the door. And even before you've closed the door all the way, so you've left, you're outside, and you begin to close the door, and you go, oh, I forgot something, you go back in, right? So you haven't, gotten to the car or gotten to where you're going. You're just barely leaving, and you change your mind, you come back. So that would be the movement equivalent. You're starting to go back to the home position, the starting place. Just starting, you stop there, and then you come back. You stop there long enough to catch your breath. And then you come back and you catch your breath again. You stay in that position and you do that a number of times. Think about what's happening here. You have gone into this shape, which means in this position, your flexors have engaged. You do this in a more... The more your extensors let go, the easier the movement is, right? So flexion is not just about the flexors engaging. It is about this reciprocal innervation where the muscles on the other side of the joint stop working. So now you are in this rounded position, and the bottom half of you, half of the position, stays the same. And you are lowering the top half. When you're lowering the top half that slowly, that is an eccentric contraction. The muscles, they're not letting go all of a sudden. They're letting go gradually, right? It is a controlled decontraction. So you are practicing lengthening the muscles. That kind of contraction, right? There's concentric, where you're lifting something, the muscle's getting shorter. Isometric, where you're holding a position and it doesn't change. And then the third type of contraction is this eccentric, lowering something against gravity. So you are practicing lengthening the muscles. It's the only time you do that. And yet, you still have to hold your pelvis up. So your flexors now have to act in a differentiated way, right? The bottom half of you has to stay in flexion. You're lowering the top half of you. The extensors have nothing to do with this because if they work up there, your head will go crashing into the floor. So you have isolated the extensors, or let's just say that for just to be simple, and you are now lengthening the muscles that you once contracted. So you spent time in the lesson building up flexion and making it easier, maybe exploring a slight rotation to find a different engagement of the muscles in front and lengthening in back. But here you're staying in that position, coming out of it just with a part of the shape that you've made. And all the rest of you is still engaged in it. That is a high degree of differentiation. Do you understand what I mean by that? What's amazing about it is startlingly effective. It also works in FI. Right? So like in an FI, let's say I was lifting someone's head, whatever position you like, just their head, not their arms. And on the way back, I just barely come back. I wait a moment, and then I return to the top of the movement. So in both of these situations, I'm taking this idea of what happens at the beginning being so important, right? It sets the stage, it sets you off in a certain way, and just changing the quality of movement, like Betty said, at the very beginning. You know, I don't know if this is something I did before. It is not something that I did consciously and repeatedly, and it is startlingly effective. So I would propose this as a more refined, I don't know, kind of next generation, an expansion and a development of the process of differentiation. And in almost every lesson, part of what happens is this dance between differentiated and undifferentiated movement. That just expands the steps you can do in that dance. And adding these to your repertoire, teaching ATM, which doesn't change any of the lessons, right? I mean, the movements that you're doing or what the lesson's about or what the function is or whatever, all that stays the same. It's just a way to make lessons more effective. And maybe because I hadn't been doing that for the longest time, when I started doing it, I just noticed how amazingly effective that was. It's like the secret ingredient. It makes whatever dish you're making even tastier. All right, well, we will, as you probably guessed, explore this in the ATM we're going to do. And then we will take this idea. I mean, you'll see at the end of the ATM how I'm going to use it. And then we'll talk about it. I'll ask you to reflect on it and share your experience. That's what's coming up next. You know, so next time somebody asks you, you know, the Feldenkrais method, Feldenkrais died a while ago, what's new? You might have one answer to add to your list if you have a list. Okay, questions, comments, snide remarks.
I have a question, please.
Yes, what? Rachel?
So is it, this dance you're saying is between differentiated and undifferentiated, and that is what shows up in eccentric movement? No.
No. So, yeah, let me clarify that. I would say in any act of a lesson, so any major section of a lesson, one of the major ways what happens in that act is organized, what we're doing with our students, is that we are to develop their awareness, to help them find ways of moving that they didn't have before. We are doing differentiated and undifferentiated movement. So, for instance, in the classic, well, okay, I'm thinking the lesson I'm thinking of, which I don't know, classic or not, kind of the archetypical in my mind, flexion lesson. At the beginning, you ask the person to lift their head, right? They're lying on their back before you do the ATM. Could be the test movement, right? They lift their head unassisted. That's moving the head, differentiated from the chest. One of the things that we do in that lesson, the first step is, or whatever, second or third, is to lift the head and the arms together. That's an undifferentiated movement. We're moving the head and the arms together. That makes the movement in the neck, right? Because this whole shape, a triangle, a double triangle of my arms, there are three legs in the triangle, my upper arm, my lower arm, my upper arm, and then this third piece. If that's a triangle, that piece, it's solid in that shape. So instead of moving in the neck, like what most people do when they lift their head, the neck disappears and they have to move in their chest. That's an undifferentiated movement. And it changes both the dynamics of the movement, the biomechanics, and it changes how somebody notices, right? That kinesthesia is the sense of movement. If there's no movement in the neck, you don't feel the lack of movement. You feel where movement is happening in the chest. So not only has the student altered their own biomechanics in that example, but they've also altered their sensory dynamics. They've changed what they notice. Or let's say in a different FI, you have one hand on the student's shoulder or upper chest and the other hand on their pelvis, and you can move both hands together. Right, so now their chest and their pelvis, their whole trunk is moving as a piece. Right, so their trunk is undifferentiated. The movement's happening. If their trunk is undifferentiated, that means there's no movement from the top of their chest to their hip joints. Right, because there's no movement in the spine or in the rib cage, everything there. It's a constraint, not necessarily of pressure. You're not holding them together. It's a constraint of timing. You move those places in parallel arcs at the same time. Nothing moves in between. Now the movement is going to be in their neck, right, if their head isn't moving. So if their head stays on the pad and everything else is moving, there's movement in the neck. And if their pelvis is moving and their legs aren't, then there's movement in their hip joints. So there's movement around the undifferentiated area. If then I move the shoulder forward, now everything's changed, right? Because now all of a sudden the movement between the shoulder girdle and the chest appears. All of a sudden their rib cage and their thoracic spine and their lumbar spine appears, because the movement's going to happen in those places. There will be no movement in their hip joints, right? So where there was movement before, down there won't be any. There may be movement in their neck, but the thing that changed is that by differentiating one part from the other, what they're sensing and where the movement's happening, in which joints the movement is happening, has changed. So we've shifted both the motor and the sensory part of the action. And what I'm saying is, in every lesson, like this example, going back and forth between undifferentiated and differentiated movements is part of, it's just part of our pedagogy. In every lesson, not necessarily in terms of, in every lesson where you're moving through space, that kind of differentiating is occurring. And that's what drives the lesson forward. And so what I'm saying is, in each of the examples that I gave, I'm showing another way to further differentiate what we were already doing. I'm saying that is worth doing because it brings a person deeper into their experience of what they are doing. You're changing how they're doing it, but you're not changing what they're doing. And that changes. Well, people commented last week on how much change in the before interview, that by noticing what was happening, that made things change, right? That noticing has that capacity. And I'm saying, this is a way of noticing and moving that makes what we're already doing even more effective. So instead of, like, if something isn't working or isn't working as well as you want, either in terms of how the person's moving or what they're noticing, rather than doing a different part of the lesson, a different scene, maybe you could just get more out of what you're already doing. That was a really good question, because if those things weren't clear, we couldn't go forward. So I'm glad you asked it, Rachel. Any other question? I'm going really slow when I'm talking about this because I tend to get overexcited, and then I go way too fast. So I hope this tempo is not just surprising you, because yes, I can go slower, but I don't mean to bore you either, but I just want to make sure that I'm pointing to something that you could say I missed, but I didn't even know it was possible before. And I'm also want to present this in a way that it's not anything different from what we've been doing. It's just a way of taking what Moshe proposed more seriously. And it's not a big stretch to imagine that as a part of the method. So I'm hoping that you feel really curious about how you might apply this in your practice. Like, let's say I was abducted by aliens right in front of you. Like, they beam me up and I'm gone. You would still have something really worthwhile to explore, right? Like, if they were editing the newspaper and they only had room for this much, I've kind of told you the most important part. We, in some ways, you know, intellectually at least, what I want to do is give you the experience of this. And by doing that, showing you or demonstrating for you in your own experience, the so what. The promise of this is you can be way better at what you're doing, no matter what level at which you're working as a teacher. Just applying these things will make what you're doing more effective. So, you know, I'm not promising the moon, but at least the first part of the ladder that will get us there. Thanks, Rachel. Okay. We're going to take a long break. Then we're going to come back and do an ATM. And I have a question. Either way, I will be fine. But what I'd like to do most of all in this ATM is do something that will require two pieces of equipment. And I don't know if you have the second one with you. The first one's a chair. Preferably one that's like a dining room chair, that's a straight back chair. If not, you just need some firm pillows to sit in it. I'm saying not a sitting on the sofa or an easy chair, because you'll sink into it and lean back too far. You could, if you had a chair that's really slopey, you could actually turn it sideways and sit against the wall, because that would give you a straight back, right? But the other thing that I'm hoping you all have is a roller, right? It could be a big roller, a 6-inch roller, or a 4-inch roller. It's better if it's firm, so not a mushy roller. As long as it's round, it could be a bolster from your sofa if it's long enough. But it won't, the lesson I want to teach won't work if you don't have a roller. So is there anybody who is rollerless or can't get one in the next 45 or 50 minutes without skipping your meal or whatever you were going to do? I don't see anybody saying they don't have a roller. Hallelujah, Jesus. All right. Cool. So I want to teach you a new lesson, which is a lesson you've done many times, just never in this configuration with space. It's part of my the last series of roller lessons I created. I'm kind of enamored with it. And, you know, I mean, how many times do we get together? And there's lots of places you can find all the lessons that already exist. But I think this is a particularly, I don't know. I just want to illustrate the points I've been making by sharing this lesson with you. So we will do a lesson in which you're sitting in a roller, or sitting on a chair with the roller behind you. The roller will be upright. So it'll be parallel to your spine, behind your spine. And if your chair is sitting back, your upper back won't touch it. So you need to have, be against the wall, a straight back chair, or have enough, not mushy pillows, but firm pillows that you can stick in there. Rolled up towels will work so that the roller stays upright. It will not stay upright, because as you move, it'll move around a bit. So you're going to have to adjust it. That'll be part of your job during the ATM. It is not onerous. And, you know, if you fail, it'll fall. You pick it up and just keep going. The roller serves a funny purpose in this lesson, because it won't be moving. It won't be rolling. But it will have a, I could say roll, but maybe that's a bit too much. It will have a job. All right. Yeah, so it is 5 minutes after the hour. So can we start at 10 minutes before the hour and 45 minutes? Yes. And that will give us just a little less than 2 hours to finish the day, which I think will be fine. All right. See you soon.